All right, we're in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and we've been talking about and looking at the qualifications of elders. We're going to try to finish that section of the book here in our study this morning. And we'll start by reading in verse number 1, but we looked at verses 1 and 2 in our last study, and so we'll just pick up right where we left off in verse number 3. But I want to read the first two verses to remind us of these things that we talked about. Paul says, "This is a true saying. If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach." We pick up in verse number 3, and the first qualification there is not given to wine. And this word in relation to not given to wine is related to what's also said in this verse, no striker. And at the end of the verse, not a brawler. All of these things are kind of tied together. So we've already seen the word sober in verse number 2. And sober had to do with being of a sound mind and self-controlled. And this phrase in verse number 3 has a very similar idea. Translated here as not given to wine. The word actually means not staying by wine. The American Standard Version translates it as brawler. And so brawler shows up later in verse 3 in the King James Version. But the idea of the word is having a lack of discipline. And the way that it's illustrated is by a person who can't leave the alcohol alone. He's become addicted to it. And because of that, he doesn't have control over himself. Instead, he's allowed this other thing to control him. And as a result, he becomes a person who is prone to not only a lack of self-control, but even toward outburst of emotion, which is going to come up in the next couple of qualifications that we'll mention. So not given to wine really has to do with the person who's not in control of himself, of his emotions, of his actions, of his responses. So it's important to know that, because this phrase, not given to wine, you know, in the qualifications of deacons in verse number 8, it says not given to much wine. And people often will say, you know, that elders can't have any alcohol and deacons can have a little bit. And we kind of talked about this last Sunday night, that not given to much wine doesn't mean you can have a little bit. It means don't have any. But these two words are really kind of using alcohol as an example of an underlying character trait. It's not just about how much you can drink or not drink. It's about having the character that is like a person who cannot control his drinking, who's become addicted to it. So that's kind of the idea here. And of course, obviously, a person who's going to serve as an elder can't be a drunkard. And can't give himself to wine and those things. But also he has to, beyond that, he has to be in control of himself to live a disciplined life. He would be a poor example to others trying to teach them to be disciplined as Christians when his own life was not, when it was in, you know, disarray and chaos, because he wasn't in control of himself. So the other part of the idea of this word has to do with contentions and quarrels. And that's something that is not appropriate for an elder of the Lord's church. That if there's a disagreement, you know, in the congregation, the response is not to get angry and shout and, you know, fight. And we've all probably heard stories about, you know, elders meetings where sometimes they come to blows. And that is completely foreign to the Bible's idea of an elder. And those who serve as elders, they have control of themselves and of their emotions. So with that in mind, I want us to talk about the next phrase, no striker, and also later in the verse where he says not a brawler. We'll talk about those two words. And I also want to take just a second and to bring in what Paul says to Titus about the qualifications of elders in Titus chapter 1. And there are several things that are parallel, of course, to what Timothy, what is told to Timothy. But he says in Titus 1 in verse 7, a bishop must be blameless as the steward of God, not self-willed, not soon angry. So these three all kind of go together, a striker, a brawler, or soon angry. And an elder is not to be those things. And those words have to do with being contentious. It's the idea, a striker is the idea of a person who is ready with a blow. At a moment's notice, when someone says something to anger them, they immediately lash out. Sometimes physically, but it doesn't have to be, you know, physically hitting someone, but lashing out in anger. So having a temper that is not under control, letting their emotions and their anger take over to the point where they're not in control of themselves. This word means abstaining from fighting or being prone to anger. So there are to be no temperamental outburst is the idea. An elder can't be a person who is a lover of quarrels. And you know, there are some people who just love to fight. They love the drama of it. They want to get into an argument and you know, whatever, for whatever reason or motive, they just like to argue. And that can't be the case for an elder. To the extent that he's not in control of himself or his emotions and things become physical, but also that you're just arguing for the sake of arguing. That's not what elders do. So not soon angry and not striking out from that or being a brawler, a person who enjoys, you know, the fight, that's not a qualification or a quality, rather, of elders. A couple of verses to help illustrate this. James chapter 1 and verse 19, James says this, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath." And that's the idea that we're talking about, being slow to wrath, to anger. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to be angry, and it doesn't mean that an elder shouldn't get angry from time to time. There are occasions when all of us as Christians should be angry, when the truth is attacked, when error comes into a congregation, when souls are led astray. That ought to make us angry, but it's a righteous anger. We sometimes call it righteous indignation, but it comes from a place of a desire for truth and to stand for the truth. And so we're angry against the error, but we don't let that emotion of anger take over and cause us to lash out and, you know, to harm other people. That's the principle that we're seeing. And the example, of course, is Jesus. In 1 Peter 2 and verse 23, we're told when he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. So when Jesus was threatened, and obviously he was in tremendous ways, if anyone had a right to be angry at how people were treating him, mistreating him, and attacking him, it was Jesus. But he suffered it, and he didn't let the emotion of the situation cause him to go against the will of God. He remained in submission to God's will, even though that meant going to the cross unjustly. He still endured that because he committed himself to the one who judges righteously. He knew God would work all things out. And that's, again, the principle here, that elders can't make it angry over false doctrine or whatever, but they don't let their emotion cause them to make a decision that goes against the will of God, to lead the church in a way that's contrary to God's will, or even act in their own lives in a way that goes against the word of God. So that's the idea of being a striker or a brawler or soon angry. And it's connected to this idea of not given to wine. Now, you notice also in verse 3, there's the phrase, not greedy of filthy lucre. And so, of course, this has to do with having a love of money. The account in Titus uses the word covetous. So not being greedy of filthy lucre is having a desire or being eager for money to the point where you don't care where it comes from, either good or ill, moral ways of making money or immoral. That, of course, ties in with the idea of covetousness. Colossians 3 and verse 5 tells us that covetousness is idolatry. And this is why, because if you love money, 1 Timothy 6:10, for the love of money is the root of all evil. If we love money, then it becomes the most important thing to us, and we'll do anything to get more of it. And so, again, whether it's honest or dishonest, if it's in harmony with God's will, Or if it's against God's will, when money is the most important thing, then that's where our focus is. And a person who's going to lead and guide and shepherd the flock of God's people, first of all, can't love anything more than he loves God, because he's taking care of God's people. But also, he's not to allow some idol into his life, such as money. And so filthy lucre is money from dishonest sources or means. This is also a matter of faith. It's a matter of our faith in God. I want to read Hebrews 13 and verse 5 to us to illustrate this, because it makes an important point in connection with covetousness. The Bible says, let your conversation, that's your manner of life, the way that you live, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And what the writer of Hebrews is showing us is that when we become covetous, we put our trust in money rather than in God. And covetousness is a sign that we don't really have faith in God, that he will never leave us nor forsake us. We think this money is going to help me and see me through this difficult situation, and so I have to have the money and hold on to the money, and it's my only source of hope. We put our trust in money instead of putting our trust in God. And that's a key thing to remember, especially as it relates to to elderships. How many times when, you know, you're trying to discuss something, the work of the church that needs to be done, the first thing that comes up is, how much money do we have in the bank, right? How much money is in our account? And we begin to reason, well, we can't do this work, we can't engage in this effort because we don't have the money. And we're afraid to spend that money or to let go of it because we need it for a rainy day, because something in the building might fall apart, we might need to do this or that. And we come up with all of these reasons that we can't do what the Lord wants us to do. And it's really a matter of trying to hold on to material things. And it's an important thing to, you know, to remember and to reflect on, that the money that we have, you know, is given to do the work of the church. And that's why God wants us, what he wants us to use it for. He's made us stewards over it. And that's what we're supposed to do with it. And the simple truth is, what Hebrews 13:5 is telling us is that if we are focused so on the material that we're afraid to let go of it, give it to God, and to use it into his service, number one, it's a lack of faith on our part. And number two, it robs ourselves of an opportunity to grow our faith. One of the greatest ways that a person, that a Christian or a congregation can ever increase their faith is to step out in faith, is to look and to say, the Lord wants me to do this, and I don't have the resources to do it. I don't know how I'm going to accomplish this. I don't know how it's all going to work out, but God says to do it, and so I'm going to commit myself to doing it, and then to watch how everything comes together for that goal to be accomplished, as long as it's in harmony with God's will. What that does is to strengthen our faith and to show us that the promises God makes are true, that he will provide for us and he will take care of us. And we may not understand how he's going to do it, and it may even surprise us when he does it, but he always follows through with his promise. And when we fail to step out on faith and do those things, we rob ourselves of the opportunity to have our faith strengthened. Instead, we've taken the safe path, and we've held on to, you know, what we have, and we become complacent with the status quo. We say everything is going well and going smoothly. We don't have any problems. There are no big obstacles. We have enough money in the bank to cover our needs, you know, to pay the light bill and all of those things. And so let's don't rock the boat. Let's just keep everything as it is, smooth sailing, and everything will be fine. And the problem with that is, whenever in the church or as a Christian you start just drifting along, you never drift against the current. You're always going in the wrong direction, right? We feel like we're standing still, we're staying where we need to be, when in fact we're not going where we need to go. God never wants us to stay where we are, but to grow and to mature and to do more and to serve more. And the only way to do that is to step out on faith. And if we're lovers of money, if the material is more important than the spiritual, then we as Christians aren't going to give as we should. Elders are not going to lead as they should. Congregations are not going to do what they should. And we won't grow. And so it's a very important principle about not being covetous, not loving money, not letting, you know, the material become more important than the spiritual. And it's also important because, you know, if an elder or the eldership, if they're lovers of money, then the people in the congregation who contribute the most money have the most say, because they can threaten, I'm going to take my contribution away if you don't do what I want you to do. And they become lords over the congregation using their money to accomplish that. And if you have elders who are greedy of filthy lucre, who are covetous for money, that becomes more important to them than standing for the truth. And so they'll compromise with error in order to hold on to material things. And sadly, it happens. And over again in the Lord's church, even with people who are scared of losing someone's contribution, they compromise on doctrine or on practice or whatever. So not greedy of filthy lucre. Spiritual things have to be more important than material things. Now, there's one other thing in verse number 3 in the middle there, and it says patient. The word in Titus that Paul uses is the word temperate. So I think the American Standard Version translates this as gentle. The idea of being patient or being temperate, again, has to do with self-control, but it means at the root, the word has to do with being appropriate. And so it's the idea of something that is suitable or fair. And because of that, it sometimes gets the idea of being mild or being gentle. But what it means is, again, it has to do with the idea of self-control. It means to have an appropriate response to the situation, right? So it's not to be overly emotional, but it's also not to be under emotional, okay? So you have the appropriate response to a situation, whatever the challenge is or the problem is or the difficulty that's being faced, it has to be responded to appropriately, okay? So someone in a Bible class teaches something that is in error, and the elders have to deal with that. How do they respond? Well, it's not an overly emotional reaction where you fly off the handle in anger and yell and scream, but it's also not an under-emotional reaction where you say it's really not a big deal. It is a big deal, and it has to be dealt with, but in a proper way, right? Like Aquila and Priscilla taking aside Apollos, that kind of thing. So that's what patient has to do with here. So it's not just patiently enduring or suffering through things. This word has to do with having self-control so that you respond appropriately to situations. So the word means to master or to control. And again, it has to do with self-control. Now, we come to verse number 4. It says, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. And then it's explained in verse 5, for if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? The statement in Titus says, verse 6, if any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. So let's talk about this. This again, of course, has to do with the elder's family and his role in the family and in the home. So first of all, he says, one that ruleth well his own house. The word for ruleth means literally to stand before. So the husband is the head of the wife. The father is the head of the children of the household. He stands before them. He's in front of them as the leader of the home. It also means to preside over. So the husband, the father, is the head of the house. And that's demonstrated in and illustrated in the idea that the husband is responsible for the spiritual direction of the home. Not just the spiritual direction, but all the directions of the home. At the end of the day, when, you know, all is said and done, the final responsibility goes to the husband, the father, as the head of the house. We say sometimes the buck stops here. Well, God has designed the home in such a way that the buck stops with the husband, with the father. And that goes all the way back to the creation. It's why God made Adam first and then Eve. It doesn't mean that the woman doesn't have a say, that she has no opinion or no choice. Obviously, husbands and wives work together, but the final responsibility is the father's, the husband's. He's the head of the house. That's how God has designed things. And we even see that in chapter 2 of 1 Timothy, which we skipped over. We're going to come back to it, though. But that's a fundamental principle that God has taught. Well, if a person is going to lead the church of God as a household, as a family, then understanding that principle of the husband or the father being the head and the final authority, then we understand that that's also true of elders in the local church. They are the final authority. They have the responsibility for the direction that the congregation goes in. All right? That's not the preacher's responsibility, even though very often it gets left to the preacher in how he preaches and what he teaches. That responsibility belongs to the elders. They guide the direction of the church. So Jesus is the head of the church, right? He's the head of the body. He's the king of the kingdom. The New Testament, the gospel, is the law of the church. And no elder, no person, no Christian, none of us have the right to change God's law. It's final. We can't add to it or take from it or alter it in any way. But in implementing that law, in the matters of expediency, the Lord commands us to assemble on the first day of the week. The elders don't have the right to say we're going to meet on Tuesday instead of Sunday. You can't change God's law, but they can say we're going to meet at 9:45 or we're going to meet at 11 or 2:30 in the afternoon. That's the matter of expediency. But that final decision is theirs. So we don't take a vote on it, even though you can get the input of the congregation. It's not majority rule. The elders make those decisions. And because they're responsible for those decisions, they have to have shown in their home life that they're able to lead their family in a godly direction, because they're going to be responsible for leading the church in a godly direction. And so again, Paul says, if a man doesn't know how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? So there are kind of three things involved in ruling in a home as a father and also in the church. First of all, there's example, setting the right example before our children and also, of course, as elders before the church. There's teaching, so instructing them in the way that they're to live. And then there's discipline. And all three of those things are also found in the church. There's the example of the elders, there's the teaching of the elders, and there's the discipline, a church discipline that takes place, withdrawal of fellowship and things of that nature, correcting those that have gone astray. Okay? So they have to have shown that they can do that in their homes in order to be qualified to serve in that role in the church. So they're to have their children in subjection with all gravity, with all seriousness. And so the idea is that the elder has shown in his home that he can maintain, he can rule, he can care for, he can protect, he can guard his family, his household, and that allows us to know that he'll be able to do the same for the church. Now, when you add to that what was said in Titus, again in verse number 6, that he is to have faithful children. That word faithful, the American Standard Version says having children that believe. But this is the same Greek word from Revelation 2 and verse 10. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. So the word means believing. And it means that an elder, in order to qualify to be an elder, the children who are brought up in his home, while they're under his authority, must obey the gospel and become Christians. He is to have believing children. So if a man in leading and guiding his home has brought up his children and they do not become Christians while they're, you know, under his authority, then he's not qualified to be an elder. And it's a strong, you know, law that God gives here, but there's an important reason for it, of course. That's the responsibility of elders. It's about making Christians and helping those who are Christians to remain faithful. And if you can't bring your own children, you know, to be obedient to the gospel, then you're probably going to have difficulty in helping the church bring people to obedience to the gospel and remaining faithful and so forth. And so it's one of those things that, you know, is unique to the eldership. To be qualified, your children must be Christians, and they have to show that they are under the authority of the head of the house. So they're not accused of riot, Titus 1:6 says, which means that's the word that illustrates what the prodigal son did. He wasted his substance with riotous living. A child who is living that way is not under the authority of his parents. And so that would disqualify a man from serving as an elder. Unruly means disobedient. So obviously, when we read these things, we're not talking about little children. You know, this is not the little baby that cries during the worship service and someone says, why can't they control their child? You know, babies are babies. They do that. This is a child who has grown to the age where he knows right from wrong and good from evil, and he refuses to be submissive to his parents and obedient to the gospel. That would disqualify a man from serving as an elder. Now, someone asks, what about, a child who obeys the gospel, and then when they leave the home, when they go away to college or they get married and start their own family and they leave the church, they become disobedient. Would that disqualify a man from being an elder? And I don't think that it does. When a person reaches the age where they leave the home, leave father and mother and cleave to their wife, they're no longer under the authority of their parents in the same sense. Still have responsibilities toward them, but they're not under their rule any longer, and people can make their decisions. But the elder has proved, or the man, you know, to be an elder, has proved in the time that they were in the home that he was leading in an appropriate way. Okay, so it's something to think about and something to be considered, but at the same time, we have to note carefully what the Bible says here. Now, one more thing in connection with this, it says having his children in subjection, and Titus says that he has faithful children. Does children mean more than one, or can it mean one child? And, you know, there are those who argue that because it says children, it has to be at least two children. And the argument usually goes that if you have two children, you have more experience than if you only have one child. But you can take that, you know, to an extreme. Jacob had 12 sons, right? And Isaac only had two. So which one would make a better elder in the church? The one who had the experience of 12 different children, or someone who only has two, right? You can go so far with that that it ends up, you know, not making sense anyway. The Bible teaches us, and, you know, we understand in the way that we use the word children that it can mean be plural or it can just refer to one child. We say we have a nursery in the back if you have children that need to use it. Well, if you only have one child, that doesn't mean you can't use the nursery, right? The Bible also uses the word children in that way. And I want to notice a few verses with you to illustrate that so we understand this principle. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 14 says, children ought not lay up for their parents, but the parents for the children. So does that mean if you only have one child, you don't have to provide for that child, only for children? Of course not. We understand that. Ephesians 6, 1 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. So if I only have one child, he doesn't have to obey me. It's only if I have children. That doesn't make any sense either, right? Ephesians 6, 4 says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Well, what if you only have one? Can you provoke that one to wrath? Of course not. So children refers to child. You have many passages in 1 Timothy where we are, which is important to note because it's in the same context with what we're reading here. But in chapter 5 and verse 4, he talks about if a widow hath children, let them learn to show piety. What if they only have one child? Does the one child not have to show piety and take care of widows. Chapter 4 and verse 14 says for the younger widows to marry, to bear children, to rule the household. So what if a younger widow marries but only has one child? She doesn't have children, she has a child. Does she violate this scripture? Well, of course not. Also, chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, talking about the widow, says if she have reared children. And so it's talking about widows who are qualified for assistance from the church. What if she only has reared one child? Is the church not able to help that widow? And again, it's obvious to us the way the Bible is using this word. Titus 2:4 says, train the young women to love their husbands and also to love their children. What if it's only one child? Do they not have to love that child? Of course not. We get the point. But there are two passages that explain this very explicitly and show that children in the Bible can refer to just one child. One example is Genesis 21 and verse 7, where Sarah says, she said to Abraham, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck, meaning to nurse children. So Sarah said that she nursed children. But how many children did Sarah have? She only had one. And that's the whole point of the story, that she couldn't have children until God miraculously, you know, gave her Isaac. But she goes on to say this. She says that Sarah nursed children. Then she says, for I have borne him a son in his old age. So she says, I have nursed children because I bore him a son. One child is children in the way that the Bible uses that word. And I think that passage shows that very clearly. There's one more I'll notice with you. In Luke chapter 20, when the Sadducees came to Jesus, of course denying the resurrection, and they told that story based on the Levirate law, the law of the Old Testament about if a man married a woman and they didn't have any children, his brother was to marry, he died, his brother was to marry his wife to raise children for him. This is what they say, verse 28, Moses wrote unto us, if any man's brother die having a wife, and he die without children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. And they go through the whole scenario. A man had seven brothers, and one died, and he didn't have children, so the second one married him, and so on. And they use it to ask a question about the resurrection. But notice what they're saying and what the law said. If a man is married to a wife and he dies without having children, well, what if they had one child? Does the brother still have to marry his wife, his widow now, to have another child with her so there will be children? Or is one child sufficient? Well, logically, you know, we think and we understand that one child meets the requirement. But just so we understand that it's not just our logic and our reasoning, I want to read real quick from Deuteronomy 25 and verse number 5. And here's what the Bible says. If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it goes on to talk about it. So you notice in the New Testament it says if he dies and they don't have children, but the Old Testament says and they have no child. So the use of children includes the singular, even though it's a plural word. And the point of all that, and to notice those verses, is to understand that the qualification for an elder having children can mean only one child. The principle is that he's demonstrated in his home that he can have authority and exercise authority and guidance over children, over a child that is his, that he has brought up. Is it better to have two? Do you get more experience from two than one? Of course you do. Children are different. But what about three? You know, you don't know what it's like to have a middle child until you have a middle child. And a middle child is different from having an older child and a younger child. What about four? You know, you can go on and on with it. But the principle is that one child qualifies a man to serve as an elder. And that's consistently the way that the Bible uses that word. And so a man shouldn't be disqualified or not considered if he only has one child. But at the same time, you may have more experience, you know, from having more children. But I want to go through that and notice some of those things with us so we can see what the Bible, you know, shows about that. We're out of time. We almost got done here. There's a few more in verse number 6, and I'll just mention these very briefly and we'll close. Not a novice means this is not a new convert, but he has experience in spiritual matters. He must have a good report of them that are without, means that he has a good example in the community and a good name before the world. Verse 7. Good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. And so it has to do with pride on one hand and then the influence on the other. And there are a couple more from Titus, and we won't have time to look at those, but he's not to be self-willed. He's to be a lover of good, and we're actually going to talk about that in our sermon this morning. So anyway, those are the qualifications of elders here in 1 Timothy 3, and I hope that we've been benefited by looking closely at these and the work and, you know, the service of elders. And so we'll stop here, and Lord willing, next week we'll start talking about the deacons. 2 weeks. We'll have gospel meeting next week. But we'll look at the deacons starting in verse number 8.